The deputy, the counsel's office to the president. A lot of people question why you need a counsel to the president in the White House when you have an attorney general. I asked the same question when someone offered me this job and trying to decide whether to go back to the Justice Department or come to the White House. The role of the counsel's office has differed from administration to administration. In fact, if you remember back in different years, you'll remember such names as Roderick Hills or John Dean, who served as counsel to the president. You go back to Clark Clifford. People served with the title but did different things. Some were speechwriters, some were general counselors. But in the past years, the counsel's role has really been the lawyer to the president. And it has certain functions which are very different than anything in the Justice Department. It's really more of a managing role from a presidential perspective. The flow of legal matters involved in presidential decisions, providing advice and services in some uniquely presidential matters, and exercising a general legal coordination role in the executive branch or through the executive branch in government. We're kind of like a gatehouse in some ways. We get from throughout the executive branch decisions on which the president are matters on which the president will have to make a decision. The legal research is done all through the government and not in the counsel's office to the president, basically in the Justice Department. We then would look at several different interpretations or several different memorandums from different lawyers throughout the government or different policymakers and make a recommendation to the president in two ways. One, which we think will comply with his campaign commitments and what we see as being in the White House with his philosophy, and two, to ensure that, in fact, is legally and constitutionally possible. We receive legal inquiries from throughout the government for information on exactly that same question. What is the president's policy on this particular issue? Specific things in this administration. We deal with such things in spite of my background and all the things I never thought I would have anything to do with, and a lot of things I thought I would have to do with that I'm not having much to do with, but we are the liaison between the president and the intelligence community. It's a very interesting responsibility. We actually serve the president and the Intelligence Oversight Board and have contact with all of the security agencies throughout the government. We also have had a rather major role in revising the intelligence community on making recommendations to the president, because we are kind of the neutral people. We have no turf problems in terms of the Justice Department or the CIA or the National Security Council, and we've played a rather major role in attempting to get all of those agencies together to make recommendations to the president on what their respective responsibilities should be. We've also had the pivotal task force, head of the task force role, in revising all the classification regulations, attempting to comply with Jimmy Carter's openness in government, and therefore putting limits on what can be classified, who can classify what, how long it can be classified. And let me give you some concrete examples of that. In the Carter White House, there's only one person that can classify documents. In the Ford White House, Nixon White House, and every other White House, as far as we can determine, there have been over 100 people. In the National Security Council, Bob Gates on the National Security Council, well, Brzezinski and Bob Gates, I mean, they are the only people who literally can classify things. That's resulted in some very different things going on in the White House. One of it is because none of us can classify things. We have a tendency and have done on a number of occasions when we receive a document which has a security classification on it and send it back to the agency and say, obviously we can read everything that's classified. We all have the clearances to do all that. But to send it back to the agency, does this need to be classified? Because our perspective is so different, because we were the counsel to the president. You couldn't find or probably a role with an attorney-client privilege involved in a security, really the security of the nation many times involved. And if we can deal without classification, we believe that a lot of other people should be able to do the same thing. We also deal with such sticky questions as executive privilege. The ultimate decider of executive privilege, I've really gotten all the civil libertarian roles in the White House, is I am the person who makes the recommendation, if there is going to be a recommendation, to claim executive privilege. Another thing I can say, in the 10 or 11 months we've been there, we have never done that. Again, it's the first administration who has ever been in office this period of time who has never claimed executive privilege on any information whatsoever. And that would be in terms of the Congress asking us for documents, regardless of their classification. It's a whole different issue because the Congress has a right to classify documents. But we have not ever yet claimed executive privilege. And I think that's got to do also with the role of the counsel's office in carrying out the philosophy of this president, which is to let the citizens and let the Congress know what's going on and share in the decision-making power. And we've attempted to do that. And legally, we've attempted to do that by, as I said, the declassification task force that we participated in and led, and secondly, by being the gatekeeper for executive privilege. We make people go back in the agencies, go back to the congressperson or the senator involved and say, work out with them a way to fulfill their need to know, and at the same time not in any way danger the security of the country or cause other problems in terms of a decision-making if the decision hasn't been made yet. It's got very much to do with the philosophy of Jimmy Carter and an openness in government, and it's the type of thing that I can tell you the difference between the counsel's role and the attorney general's role. We have one client, that's Jimmy Carter. The attorney general has one client, and that's the country, and its citizens. Hopefully, those will never be opposite in terms of responsiveness or responsibility or any conflict in terms of what either the president wants or the country wants. But our clients are very different. And we would go to the attorney general, and we have, and to people in the Justice Department, and say, the president is insisting on openness. We want you to work out with the Congress this particular document, the information in this particular document, and turn it over. And that's where our roles really do differ, is we really follow the directive in a philosophy, obviously within legal and ethical bounds of what can be done and what should be done. As I said, we counsel the president generally. Bob Lipschitz has known the president for any number of years, and he and therefore we are involved in a lot of non-legal matters and policy matters as well as legal matters in the government. We've also picked up the responsibility which we inherited during the transition of approving all presidential appointees for potential conflict. We rule on all conflict issues in the government for potential either presidential appointees prior to their appointment or after they've been appointed. Again, you'll think of a couple of names like Burt Lance and Bob Mendelson in terms of the kind of sticky situations we deal with on a day-to-day basis in terms of real people. The other side of those kinds of well-publicized issues in terms of disclosure and conflict, there's a whole other side to it, which is the hundreds of people who have come into the government and have, in fact, given up, not only put in blind trust, but given up really large amounts of money and security, future security in terms of pensions and in terms of lump sum payments when they left their jobs, because we didn't allow them. We thought there would be a conflict of interest involved in coming into the government. So there are a lot of people who have given up and really sacrificed to come into the government and have complied. Everyone obviously has complied with the guidelines, which are higher than and stricter than any standards, again, that have been used in the federal government so far. We also do all of the routine kinds of things in the White House that lawyers do, which means we decide things like who can fly on Air Force One without paying. We do all the legal housekeeping matters in the White House. You know, someone will call us and say, can we accept a gift from an ashtray from so-and-so, or a foreign head of state is here, and can we visit with them without violating some other kind of regulation? So we really function as a little law firm for the White House staff, the senior staff of the White House, and any questions that they have on any issues, they come to us, and their range is unbelievable in terms of, as I said, everything from accepting a gift. We've had some situations where coming into Washington, a lot of the well-known people who have come into the Carter administration have been offered, you know, terrific deals on buying homes. And we're the ones who kind of go in and say, you can't do that, and attempt to find out what is a fair price in a negotiation. So that in the end, there is no conflict or an appearance of conflict in people who come into the government, either on the White House staff or outside. We are also a very special assignments office. Our office is the office who did the pardon of all Vietnam-era draft evaders. We drafted all the executive order. We also, I myself headed the task force which did the upgrading, special discharge review program for Vietnam-era veterans. We have handled all the Indian claims. If you have read about it in the papers, the Maine Indians have a claim on three-quarters of Maine, which is giving Maine some problems necessarily. And our office called in a special counsel and negotiated between the government of Maine and the Indians. And we're doing that in several other states. So there are a lot of kind of things that come up that either the president will say, we want Bob Lipschutz in his office to handle this, or come the other way, which one of the situations in the Indian situation came from the governor of the state, who asked the counsel's office in the White House to intervene and act as a negotiator. Right. In terms of what I think the White House has done in terms of women, specifically either the counsel's office or other people, when we were first there, which, as you heard, I came out of the campaign. I was not an early Carter supporter. I was a rather late Carter supporter. I came became a Carter supporter in the spring, but joined the campaign in August and worked in the transition. And I was still curious, I must say, to find out what Jimmy Carter would do on certain issues, especially civil rights, because I really basically have been for 10 years a civil rights lawyer. And one of the first things I thought was determinative, though not well publicized and certainly not a major issue, of how he would go on these kinds of issues, because we inherited a Title VII case, a sex discrimination case against the White House by a woman who was working in the press office under Ford. She said she was being, it was really an equal pay case. She said she was being paid less for the same work than a man who was in the press office at the White House. We inherited the case. The Justice Department had already filed a brief saying that the White House was not within the jurisdiction of Title VII. The legislative history on Civil Rights Act of 64 and its amendments in 72 is very ambivalent, I mean, ambiguous, and I think it was probably ambivalent. They didn't know what to do about the White House because the White House is exempt from every other law that exists. We do not have to comply with fair labor standards. We do not have to comply with Freedom of Information Act. We are exempt from everything. So there was no question in my mind as a lawyer in talking to a client, the president, that we could argue and probably win the case that the White House was not covered by Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, and therefore we were prohibited probably morally, ethically, and maybe constitutionally from discriminating on the basis of race, sex, and national origin, but we were certainly not covered by the specific statute. We gave him both sides, and he voluntarily covered the White House by Title VII. He said, drop. We gave him the recommendations and the options, and they were mixed in the White House. I mean, there were people on both sides of the issue saying, you shouldn't do this, you should do this. And so he did not get a uniform recommendation. And he himself decided to cover the White House voluntarily. He said, if we've got to serve as the examples to the government, there's no reason that the executive branch, starting with the White House, should be exempt from Title VII. I was impressed with that because I think when you hit home, and he was hitting home by his own personal staff, the whole executive office of the president, the people who directly work for him, that means something. I mean, obviously you shouldn't discriminate on the basis of sex and race, but most employers having the option of deciding whether or not they want to be covered by the law would rather say, we'll voluntarily do it, but we don't want to be covered by the law. That option was also given to him, and he decided, no, we will be covered by the law. The Justice Department was then, we directed them to drop the brief, to withdraw the brief, which questioned the jurisdictional issues, and decide the case on the merits. So that was very early on. And since that time, I think Jimmy Carter has done a number of things directed right from the White House to the agencies. I think as you heard Rosalynn Carter, if you did hear her yesterday morning, talked about a directive that was sent out just this past week to all federal agencies saying that we're really serious, we want you to enforce the executive order on sex discrimination in the federal government. He has directed and has been set up a sex discrimination task force in the Justice Department, which existed under Ford, but was never funded. And so that task force's role is to look at, again, the federal government, look at all the statutes, the federal laws and regulations and programs to see if they have any disparate impact on women, and then to make recommendations to the Congress or to the President or to the Cabinet Secretary to make changes in those laws, regulations, or programs. We have, as you know, the Carter administration is strong advocates of ERA. We've been criticized and severely for it, and again, our office has been involved because we've been defending the actions of several of the White House staff people and of the President and Mrs. Carter on their lobbying efforts on ERA. It shows you how strong, I mean, they have really taken a lot of criticism for their actions, and as have a number of White House people, but he came to the job with that kind of a commitment, and I think he stuck very clearly to his support of ERA. We were involved for several weeks, and I got calls from Liz Holtzman every day, I think, during those several weeks, on the ERA extension period for ratification. We work with the Justice Department very closely, with the Congresswoman very closely, to get an opinion which, again, followed the philosophy of the administration and the President, but was still legally correct, and I think we finally did that. But what was important is that the Justice Department did understand that if it was legally and constitutionally possible, the President wanted to support the extension of the period for ratification of ERA. So again, that's where the counsel role fits in as the go-between the Justice Department and the President. A number of other initiatives we've taken, I'm sure you've heard about, and you'll hear from other women in the administration rather than from me, but the directive on redlining, which came Vice President Mondale announced the other day in terms of housing. We've taken some initiatives on credit. Women in Business is a rather large program which has come directly from the White House, again, directed to the Small Business Administration to involve women in business ownership, both by support and given technical assistance by the Small Business Administration. This goes back to my civil rights legal days. I'm sorry, too, I didn't explain it. Redlining is when you have a neighborhood which a bank will redline and will not give credit to someone, which are poor neighborhoods, minority neighborhoods. And this is the first time, this did not come from the Housing Administration, it came from the Vice President, it was directed to the Federal Home Loan Bank Board. And we're getting into the credit community, we're not just talking about enforcing civil rights by the Department of Housing, but enforcing it by the Federal Home Loan Bank Board. I have been involved directly as the White House person, again, to receive the recommendations on a task force, which Eleanor is talking about next door and advocating and lobbying, I'm sure, on the reorganization of equal employment opportunity enforcement in the federal government. We set up a task force, which is in the Executive Office of the President, directed by Howard Glickstein at OMB, and several of us in the White House will look at that, have looked at, have been involved, had a meeting with the President on Friday to make our recommendations, and it will go forward. And the decision on Friday by the President was that the reorganization, which is a second reorganization, the first one was Energy Department, on equal employment opportunity. We will reorganize the agencies, there are now 28 agencies who have enforcement responsibility in EEO. And what it results in is a conflict between the agencies, an overlap, a misuse of services. And what it results in terms of victims of discrimination is poor services. And what it results in terms of the business community and those people who would be sued or would be respondents in a case is a lot of confusion and also a lot of excuses, because they say we don't know which rules to follow, whether to follow EEOC's guidelines on testing or whether to follow civil services guidelines on testing, or who's, and they've actually come into court and argued that. So it was a high priority in the campaign, stated as such. It's the second reorganization we will put forth, hopefully either this month before Congress goes out of session, or we'll certainly go in January. Let me give you 2 minutes, since you won't hear, Eleanor, on what that's going to be. The recommendations will be under consideration. Is that the Office of Federal Contract Compliance, which now enforces the executive order, there are now 11 agencies which have that enforcement power delegated to them by the Labor Department, GSA, the Department of Defense, go out and look at contractors which they give money to see if they're complying or whether they're discriminating on the basis of race or sex. That will now all be pulled back into the Labor Department. And the enforcement of the executive order and the Office of Federal Contract Compliance Program will now all be centered in the Labor Department. And the reason for that is it just hasn't worked. In the history of the executive order, which is over 20 years, there have only been 6 contracts ever dropped by the federal government because of discrimination. And there was a feeling that some drastic measures were needed, and it would have to be one person responsible or one agency responsible, which is now going to be the Labor Department. EEOC will be the agency where some other EEO responsibilities are transferred. The suggestion, which is still being analyzed, is with the Equal Pay Act responsibilities of the Labor Department will move, though maybe not right away, but will move eventually to EEOC, as will age discrimination enforcement move from the Labor Department to EEOC. The coordinating activities of what is now called Equal Employment Opportunity Coordinating Council will move to EEOC. EEOC will have the lead role, in other words, in the Equal Employment Opportunity, and they will have the coordinating role with all of the agencies. Another, I think, significant move is that the suggestion and recommendation is that the Civil Service Commission responsibilities for EEO in the federal government will move to EEOC. So if you're a federal government employee, you will no longer go to the Civil Service Commission to complain about discrimination. You will go to EEOC to complain about discrimination. These are all still, as I said, recommendations. They have been presented to the President, and what he has directed is that those involved go out and talk to groups. Many of them have been consulted along the way, women's groups and civil rights groups and the business community. But to go out again and talk about the recommendation and go out and consult with Congress and then come back before we make a final decision on the moves I just outlined to you, before it was presented as a reorganization plan to Congress, which, as I said, hopefully would be the end of this month, but will probably now be until January. If you represent groups or as individuals have any suggestions or problems about those things, this is the time to voice them to Eleanor Holmes Norton or to Howard Lickstein, who heads the task force. There's going to be a lot of activity within the next month, and people are going to be out looking for ideas and suggestions. As you know, there were 3 possibilities with EEO enforcement. One is to leave it the way it is, disorganized, no one running it, and everybody doing it, and not a very good job of it. 2 is to create a super agency, which would take everything. I mean, there would be no other agency, be one agency that enforced equal employment opportunity only. And the 3rd was to do what the recommendation is, to combine some and then have a central coordinating force, which is going to be EEOC in this. That tells you a little bit about EEO, because you didn't get to hear Eleanor anyway. I want to say some things about specifically about women in the administration and what I think you should be doing and we should be doing. Is I really do believe that there's more access to this administration by women's groups and by women than ever in the history of this country. I am a Fed. I've been in and out of the federal government. I've been a lobbyist outside as a woman's lobbyist for women's causes and a civil rights activist on the outside of the government trying to get in, knowing how impossible it has been. I think women now do have access. There's a group of women, representative of women's groups around the country, who meet biweekly with Stuart Eisenstadt, who is the head of policy, the chief policy advisor to the president. They don't meet just on women's issues. They meet on all issues. They had input into tax reform, welfare reform, anything that we've been doing. Women's groups have had an opportunity to have input early on, before the decision was made, before they were even public. I mean, they're really being used, the representatives of women's groups are really being used as consultants to the government. I think with that accent comes a large amount of responsibility as well. We have been criticized severely by women's groups on a number of issues, and I think rightly so. I also think that we've done some very good things, and we've heard very little from women's groups that we had any sense of approval. One of the most amazing kind of experiences I've had, being as if you call this the close to the top, in dealing with cabinet office and with senior level people in the White House, is that, you know, you try very hard and you work very hard to do some things, and you hear a lot of criticism for what you do all the time. And you would believe that the Bob Lipschitzes and the Stuart Eisenstadts and the Ray Marshalls are immune to criticism. Well, they're very human people. And one of the most amazing things I saw was that once that I remember, the administration made an appointment of a woman, which was lauded by women's groups. And the National Women's Political Caucus sent a rose to Hamilton Jordan and a note saying, thank you, this was terrific, we appreciate, you know, what you've done and some efforts. And, I mean, it was kind of the talk of the White House, and not laughingly so. I mean, someone actually noticed that we did something that was okay. And in cabinet meetings and in other places, you'll hear people who kind of, you really get dragged down by criticism. I think it's very important to be vocal and critical. When we do bad things, tell us. When we don't do enough, tell us. But when we do something good, tell those people that did it. Because you will find reinforcement is an amazing tool after them. You call up somebody, you write somebody a note, and you say, you know, I know what you did in that program, and I know it took some guts, and we appreciate it, or we appreciate that appointment. That's remembered, because that doesn't happen very often. And that's also very political. And I think women and civil rights groups have a lot to learn in terms of politics, is that I always thought because I was on the right side, I didn't have to be a politician. I mean, I was on the right side of justice. I was on the right side of civil rights and women's groups. We're wrong. I mean, we're very naive. You have to be very political. And what I just said does not sound political, but it is political. Because let me assure you that the Business Roundtable or IBM contacts the Secretary of Commerce or the Secretary of the Treasury Department when they make a decision that, in fact, they approve of and is helpful to the business community. And it's remembered because all of these people, regardless of their positions, are still people. And they're also politicians. And you have to remember all of that, and we have to remember all of that. I think also that there are a lot of women in the administration who come out of women's groups and civil rights groups, and as I said, who have a real commitment to you and to the things that went on at IWI this weekend. And I think that we look to you for several things. One is for suggestions about what we're doing, and the other thing is for support. I think we too should be criticized. But one of the things I've also found, and again, you talk to the women in the administration and you think that they're immune too, is that women are more critical of the women in the administration. And I understand that because we should be more responsive. But also, when the women are in responsible positions and do good things, it ought to be well known, too. Because it's supportive for us, and it helps us in our jobs to be more effective and to grab onto more power as we go along to do more of the things that we got there in the first place for. We all have had hard decisions in deciding a lot of people who were kind of the classical outsiders coming into the government. And one of the things you should know is it's a lot of a struggle with the kind of what we can do and what we can't do. And I think there are a lot of principled people, men and women in the administration, who are struggling with those questions and have been struggling with those questions about how much you can do. The Carol Foremans of the world and the Esther Petersons about who have strong, long histories of advocacy, to come inside of the government is difficult. Difficult. And we need your support, and we need your suggestions to tell us what we should be doing, because we sometimes lose contact, and coming to a meeting like this is very important to us. And when you have meetings, invite some of the women in the administration to come. I think you'll find that they're very responsive, and they want to stay in touch with what's going on. We still haven't done enough in terms of women appointments. And that's another thing I think you should... The jobs are still there. People are still leaving. There are new jobs all the time. I think the pressure should be kept up constantly on the administration to appoint women. Not only women, but men who are sensitive to women's issues. Well, I mean, the other thing you hear is you have a commission with five commissioners, and there's one woman seat. So there's been a woman... Once a woman wants a seat, a man can never sit in it, I'm convinced. I think that's fine. I think once we grab our territory and turf, we certainly should hold on to it.